Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the University of Sussex Business School. This is our final part of episode 47, where we are continuing to discuss Albert and Wenton's 1985 text, Organizational Identity. To get the text and for more information, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Welcome. In this episode, we're going to look at the reading from the point of view of lessons learned and implications for other research and themes and questions that made us look at current phenomena differently.
Okay. What I'd like to do is tell a little bit more about what happened in the stand-up of Africa Command, because I believe that that illuminates a number of the topics in which we've discussed, but also will bring us into some other important aspects of how, say, for example, I approach strategic communication. The United States military, one whole segment of the military is devoted to partnership activities and regional expertise. And so we have what we call a combatant command, whose responsibilities are to handle U.S. military activities in particular regions of the world. And so we've had one that was focused on Europe. We've had one that's focused on Pacific, basically Asia and the Pacific Rim. North and South America have had theirs. So for a period of time, there's been discussion about whether we should have such a command for Africa. And the continent of Africa for U.S. military programs was divided among the European, the Middle Eastern command known as U.S. Central Command, and the Pacific Command, because we just didn't have very much going on in Africa. And so the decision was made around, you know, the mid-2000s to create a new command. Now, at the time in which this idea was being tossed around, the United States was struggling a little bit in operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so some of those struggles were translating into criticisms against creating this command. In particular, the Africa, of course, has a very, very long colonial history, which is not necessarily fully appreciated. And so the African peoples, many of them were just in general always concerned about what colonial powers or former colonial powers are doing. And they perceived that this move was an attempt of the United States to try to create a new, or basically a form of neocolonialism.
Right, or a new form of imperialism, right? So you can understand why they might be touchy, given the fact that pretty much every single border in Africa was designed by some European third party.
Absolutely. And there's still, you know, considerable issues. Without going into too much depth, there's a lot of considerable issues between African nations and their former colonial powers. It's a continuous debate. And then within the United States government, there was some standing animosity or conflict between the State Department and the Defense Department. This wasn't particularly new for that period. It's a long-standing tension between how does the United States project itself worldwide? Hard power versus soft power, or, you know, military coercion versus diplomacy, that sort of thing.
Right. Diplomacy, social support, training, education, those kind of things.
And at the time, you know, with the relationship being a little bit on the lower side, there was a lot of discussions about militarization of foreign policy, which is basically a way of saying that, you know, we basically try to engage with other nations with our military first at the expense of diplomacy. So that's sort of a view. So what's important here is you've got several layers of organization involved. You have the national level, you have a cabinet department level, And you have then the unit, the organizational level, in which you have different perspectives about where identity and image come into play. Because at the national level, you have the central character of the United States as benevolent superpower. You have the department levels, which are at sort of at two departments who are somewhat at odds from their perspective. And then you also have the relationships with, say, African partners. And so when it came down to the creation of the command, it inherited a lot of these tensions. Okay. And those tensions, by essentially inheriting them, something that they didn't want to inherit, of course, those tensions made things difficult for the command to really want to establish its own identity, which was going to be heavily soft power and was going to be heavily based in security cooperation.
Yeah, and like Greta said, that's not something you get to control, right? That's how other people see you. And right, and the other thing I want to point out that may not be obvious to the listeners is, you know, many times in businesses when you're designing a new product or doing something different, it's easier to take this clean sheet approach, as we say in the United States, to the design, saying, okay, I have this blank piece of paper, what am I going to do? And so that's a little bit easier, but one example where corporations worry about this history affecting them. One example is when IBM designed their personal computer many, you know, decades ago in the 80s, they actually moved the team to a separate building and, you know, away from all these corporate influences because they thought that would help. And what Tom is talking about is this design issue is actually not something that happens very often in the military. You don't often stand up major commands like this, where you do get a chance to take something of a clean sheet of approach. And one of the things I think it's important he's pointing out is, even if you think that's what you're doing, you're not really doing that, because the people that you bring to the organization have preconceptions and have notions of these rivalries and these differences, different views. So I think this is a great illustration of identity conflicts or differences that occur in organizations.
Oh, even more so, there was an active debate as to just how much of a clean sheet we were going to be given, because there is a standing identity that we inherited of what we do as a regional command, which we wanted to distance ourselves from a little bit because we were going to be focused on very specific types of activities. The challenge for the command was that, you know, it had to not only establish its own identity, but also project that identity, which is to say to project an image which was in conflict with what everybody was expecting. The way that it was done was essentially through three things. And this is why the article, the original Albert and Whetton article, just struck me so much. Because the first thing was it asserted it's a different central character, and which was in direct opposition to what the criticisms were. Okay. So basically it was negate the opposing message and insert our own, you know, it's basically say, you're wrong, give us a chance. In so many words, that was what we were saying. We definitely claimed ourselves to be a distinct organization. All of the things that we inherited about, well, we're just another regional command, we simply ignored. And we made a lot of claims about how we were distinct from other commands in order to distance ourselves from, you know, all of the noise going on at the national and departmental levels. And the history was really important, because in a lot of ways we were trying to distance ourselves from our own history. You know, we were basically saying, this is, you know, we're starting from day one as a different organization. And again, it was reinforced with the idea of give us a chance. And so then over time, and it took a couple of years, we basically reiterated the messages, you know, reasserted these identity claims, both externally, with basically every single time that we did something, we demonstrated how the activities were in alignment with our identity claims. And we had a very, I don't want to say onboarding program, orientation for new members to come in, because we were going to be bringing in, you know, we grew from like 60 to 2,000 in the span of a year, something, you know, some incredible numbers of people that we're bringing in. And we had to reorient them to embrace this new identity and forget what they thought a regional command was about. It took 2 years, but we changed a lot of minds. And what happened was, is that basically the criticisms went mute. They didn't go away, but the criticisms went mute. And it basically provided us with a lot more freedom to, room where we were able to do things without, you know, some of the critics were just basically after us. No matter what we did, we were wrong. You know what I mean?
Right, because they saw you as that kind of different. Their view of your identity was this historical view, or what we've done in the past, or this template that they had. And I was wondering, when you said that a lot of the criticism probably didn't go away, but it was muted. Do you believe this banging the drum pretty regularly, saying we're different, give us a chance, you know, give us a chance. You think that helped mute that a little bit, to give you guys a chance to then establish that track record, because you were getting all this heat on the front?
Absolutely. But the reason why I say that the criticisms only went mute is because then in 2011 we had operations in Libya, and this wasn't Africa Command's doing. It was part of a UN security resolution, but it was because of that. Then all of a sudden, a lot of the critics who had been silent came up again and started to say, you know, pointed us as saying, see, we told you so, after being silent for so long.
Oh, yeah. So, that was quite the, yep, exactly.
Yeah, but that taught me quite a bit about this idea of not just identity of an organization, you know, like Africa Command's identity, but it also told me about the identity of the critics. Because you think about, you know, let's say that the central character of your organization is oriented on criticism of another organization. We exist to be the foil for you. that phenomenon became fascinating to me as I went back and to tell this story about, just because you think you've got the environment in your favor now, you've got to watch out, because, you know, silence is not necessarily golden. You know, it just may mean.
Right. It's not acceptance, right? They could be just like you're saying, still thinking the same way, but just not saying anything, right? So when you get this stressor that you're talking about, these things are going to come back. And one of the things I was thinking about, and I wonder if you have some thoughts on this, is whether you might see this as some form of cognitive dissonance, right? Where they're interpreting the things that you're doing in light of the movie or the thing that's playing in their head over what they think you are, you know, what their perception of your image is versus some other perception based on, I'm not going to say the facts, but based on what's happening. You think there was some cognitive dissonance going on there where you didn't really change their minds, that they just stopped talking? And then when they got this chance to comment, it was, aha, you know, we told you guys, is this going on? Because what I was wondering is, did you see, I don't know if you were still at Africa Command in 2011, but did you see things that you would have interpreted, hey, we were doing that they were responding differently, Africa Command was, than you would have expected based on this mission that they had? Did you see things like that?
Well, I was there through the first phases of the operation, and you know, from inside, we didn't really see this episode as really changing who we were, because you know, it was just something that we had to do.
Right, and I didn't mean it that way. Yeah, I didn't mean it that way. What I meant was, did you see when you guys were taking the action and executing what you thought was appropriate with your mission? Were there discussions internal where you were saying, yes, we know it used to be done this way, but we're, you know, this way is the way we're going to do it. You know, this break from history, this fact, this illustration that we're different.
Okay.
Did you have was there some internal discourse
over
that?
Well, we had the advantage of being able to sort of segregate, you know, we had a part of the organization that was involved in the in taking care of that, whereas the rest of the organization just kept marching along its own beat. You know, we still had all the other programs ongoing in the continent, and they went on uninterrupted. So in a lot of ways, I wouldn't call it cognitive dissonance, but we segmented ourselves. And then when the operation was over, I don't want to say it went away. That was after I left, but there were conversations afterwards. And this was documented in a monograph a couple of years later that continued on that Africa Command had to face the question of, okay, does this mean that we're, a different mix of hard and soft power? It highlighted a need to reassess the identity based on the idea that, you know, perhaps they're going to be involved in more operations in the future.
Okay. And that's actually what I was getting at was there this assessment that you guys had to say, did we perform the way we expected? Do we now need to change? You know, those kinds of things. And it sounds like the answer to that question is yes, that you at least had the conversations about them. So you could say, you know, at one level, you could call it lessons learned. But I would say in a higher level, it's more like discourse over identity. And did it need to change? Did you act in consonance with your identity? You know, those kinds of things.
And in a way, that also relates to more commercial organizations when they have to make decisions about new product investments, like expanding their product line, and whether they will do it under the brand of their current organization or whether they will establish like a spin-off where they under which they put these activities. So it's about this continuity and change of the organizational identity, but also the organizational image. And
did you see that when you were doing your research? Did you see the conversations around those kinds of topics?
Yes. One of the projects I studied was a radical innovation project where they made a very, very different product than they were currently making. And there were discussions like, should we establish this as a separate business or should we put it on the umbrella of Mirai, the Netherlands subsidiary? And cost-wise, the latter option was considered, and that happened in the end. But identity-wise, they were first thinking of putting it under a separate organization, making it a separate business.
So really interesting that this topic of identity comes up more often than I would have thought so, right? Because if you're talking about retrenchment, that's one thing, right? And you're talking about new product innovation.
Yeah, and like when you think about technology life cycles and the continuity and change of an organization, like you want to exist as an organization, but the technology has different life cycles. So you have to change what you're actually making. What you, for instance, now see is that a lot of, when you think about digital technology, a lot of the established firms, they really change their product portfolio, but they still have their brand, their image. For instance, Microsoft, but instead of having products, they now offer services, which is very different. So exactly what you were talking about, Tom, is like you start this new set of operations in Africa, which is like an addition to what is happening. You want to do that differently, and you inherit an identity that you can try to combat. And it feels like you did a lot of identity work there to establish this other organizational identity of the Africa group compared to the rest. But you might also think like, I want to avoid all this and just portray it to the outside world as a separate business.
Yeah. There's no question we did a considerable amount of identity work during that time. And it wasn't just at the organizational level. It was at the individual level. Because, you know, one of the other things that I didn't touch on that was really central to this is that at the time in which the command started, we had very little, comparatively little internal expertise in African matters. because most of the U.S. military, their expertise is going to be either in Europe, the Middle East, or the Pacific, because that's where we have the majority of our activities, or it's where we have the majority of our forces stationed. So we didn't have a big pool of folks to bring in with a lot of African expertise, and we had to change in a lot of ways at an individual identity level. We had to turn a lot of people into what we called Africanists. We had to get people who saw themselves as being African experts so that they could perform their roles differently from what they thought they might have been doing when they came in. And so one of the things that this also kind of brings up is that, you know, I talked about how there was multi-level aspects of identity from, say, the national level down to the organization level. Wetton's work that went between the two articles that we read did a considerable amount of work in bringing in that multi-level aspect of identity, of looking at it as almost basically an inherently multi-level phenomenon that went all the way from the organization down to the individual level. And that allows us to kind of talk about, you know, use the same language when we think about how, you know, salience of identity, identity work, and all of these other topics is kind of the same thing at the individual level and the organizational level. And and I think that really made, you know, the updated construct really powerful.
I agree there. And that also touches upon something I found striking, what he said there. And it also made me think about previous discussions we had on organizational memory and organizational learning, where they also take like concepts from psychology from the individual level and start to theorize it at the organizational level. And Wetton argues in his 2006 article that in such cross-level theorizing in organizational studies, the organizational constructs borrowed from the individual level of analysis, they need to have the same structures. They don't need to have the same structures, only the same functions. And he illustrates this saying that the form memory at the organizational level is quite different from its form at the individual level. And I thought, like, how do we see that with identity, that when we think about the structures of identity and the individual, we made the parallels here, but
I'll address that sort of from a practical perspective, and I know that this probably won't be satisfactory from a theoretical perspective. But I use, you know, when I'm talking with organizational leaders on matters of culture and identity, I do use the same structures. I talk about central character of an individual, distinctiveness of individuals, the historical context of individuals. You know, basically, I use the same language, and I think it works. I think it resonates well. Now, one of the other things I think is worth mentioning, because I think there was a very interesting linguistic trick that I detected that I've used. You notice that in the original Albert and Wetton article that how the three factors of central character, distinctness, and temporal continuity are treated as nouns. But then when you in 2006, they turn into adjectives. And that was the CED, the central, enduring, and distinctive meanings. Okay, so you know, it's an important kind of a word game in my mind. The articles transitioned from talking in terms of nouns and verbs and moving to adjectives as descriptors of other nouns. So rather than an or approach, I take the and approach. I use them as both nouns and adjectives. And it kind of opens up being able to talk in identity terms in a whole wide range of ways that can resonate with a client or an organizational leader who may be accustomed to talking a certain way. That's, you know, again, that probably pushes the boundary of the theory. But when we talk about trying to help an organization understand, you know, better approach change from, you know, sort of a holistic fashion, you're going to go through transformational change. You're changing your identity. You've got to use kind of a holistic language in order to help them understand how they're going to explain to their own members, this is what the change of identity is going to mean to us, and this is what it's going to mean to you.
Thanks for sharing that, Tom. What I wanted to bring to the table, and I'd love to hear your perspective on, is at the end of his article, the 2006 paper, Wetton actually warns against the overuse of organizational identity as an explanation for organizational phenomena. And I think it's on page 229, and he states that organizational identity is most appropriately invoked in organizational scholarship as an exceptional explanation. That is, when other explanations won't do.
Yeah, and that's sort of, I think that touches on a difference between, say, a scholarly use of a construct and a practical use of a construct. You know, in a practical setting, I look for how can I convince others or basically use theory as a lens to explain or to recommend what they must do. I recognize where Wetton is coming from a scholarship standpoint, because of course, what you don't want to do is add so much. As a matter of fact, part of the reason why he wrote the 2006 article was because identity as a construct was getting, you know, extended far beyond its usefulness. But then ultimately, we have to find ways to help organizational leaders, you know, make better decisions for their organization. And I like, you know, it's not that I go to talk to somebody and say that, you know, organization identity suggests that you do this, but it's, you know, it's basically using the vocabulary as a nice ready toolkit, using as simple language as possible, explain, you know, how identity can illuminate what decisions they're facing and follow through. And so in that regard, I use the identity construct quite a lot to help leaders understand the culture of their organization. So, you know, like, for example, culture is, we like to, you know, using the Shine model, you talk a lot about artifacts. Well, we all know that there is all sorts of different kinds of artifacts. So when you're talking about the artifacts of an organization, what kind of things are you talking about? And identity, you add identity to that, you get a language that helps you segregate artifacts into different types. Now you can help with parsing out parts of the organizational culture from each other and perhaps illuminate decisions that a leader might not have been able to make. And I use identity a lot that way. Identity doesn't prescribe this, but it sure describes a lot.
On that note, we're going to close out the episode. I hope you've enjoyed listening to it as much as we did talking about this idea of organizational identity and the author's attempt in both articles to create this tractability for the concept of organizational identity. And Tom was just talking about a really important part of that is about picking how you use the language that is also congruent with the theory, but also is something that the people at the working level can understand, because it does require explanations. We didn't get a chance to talk too much about the methodology the authors proposed in the first article or the book chapter, Extended Metaphor Analysis, but you can read that for yourself. Please join us next time here on Talking About Organizations.